real life superpowers.
The first time was successful. We had a great outcome. We built a really nice company. And one of the things that we tend to forget sometimes are the fact that it wasn't that easy, or putting it lightly, it was damn difficult. It's like kids, when they wake you up at night, you're saying, I'm not having any more kids. And 3 years later, you land up having more kids. We tend to forget some of those things. And, you know, I think doing it now kind of for the third time, the journey is important. I also think, you know, the things that I've learned along the way is surrounding yourself in people that you want to spend the journey with. I think, you know, I'm fortunate enough that as CEO, I almost get to pick people that we can partner with.
Welcome to Real Life Superpowers, where we explore the journeys of top performers. Today, we're joined by Mark Geffen, currently the CEO of Ionix, a leader in the cybersecurity space that recently secured a $42 million Series A. Mark's career spans 2 decades in cybersecurity. In 2008, he co-founded Encapsula, later acquired by Imperva. He's since held leadership roles at leading companies such as Bessemer Venture Partners and Nexar. He leads, invests in, and mentors cyber startups. He's got many insights on leadership, perseverance, and making things happen. Let's dive into his mind.
Real life
superpowers.
Superpowers.
Mark, welcome to Real Life Superpowers.
Hey, Mark.
Hey, how are you doing? Thanks for having me.
So, what's taking up most of your brain space these days?
Trying to run a startup.
Not your first rodeo, though.
No, definitely not my first rodeo. No two rodeos are the same, even if it's running a startup. Every rodeo has its own dynamics, its own challenges. There's no playbook. You can't ask ChatGPT to write the recipe for doing a startup. When they do that, then I think we'll be done. We'll have to come up with something else to do, not just startups.
But by the way, it's sort of heading there, isn't it?
You know, I almost set the ultimate challenge of building a successful startup. Like, you know, there's no real recipe book for it. And I think that, you know, AI is still at the recipe stage. I mean, that's just my perspective. I do think that it's going to change the way we do everything. I mean, it's already changing the way we do everything, all the way from, you know, no one writes original content. Everyone's a super fast learning prompt engineer these days. We're all writing, you know, trying to get the chatbot to produce content that we want it to do, and to try and, you know, optimize the output. But, you know, everyone's doing it. My kids are doing it. My spouse is doing it. He's a lawyer, so everyone's doing it. But I think it's still a way until the ChatGPT builds startups.
So you're saying it's not the same, and of course it isn't, but it has to feel like having, you know, sold a startup already and then working in Bessemer and working with entrepreneurs, you have a lot of experience seeing both ends of this equation. So is it, in a sense, easier?
I think it is easier, but I think it's easier not because you come up with better answers for the problems that you've got, but you've gained enough experience to realize that there's some common themes. There's a lot of perseverance that needs to go into it. It's not going to be a smooth sail. What that means is that it doesn't shake you as much as it used to in the past. You build resilience. You build ways to, and I mean, when I say you build resilience, it's both in your ability to make decisions. It's to rely on the team. It's how do you keep your mental resilience going. I mean, it's a definitely tough roller coaster. You got to learn to celebrate the wins, because we tend to focus on the, I don't even want to say the half empty glass, because sometimes there's just 10 or 15% in that glass that's empty, and you're constantly looking to how to fill that glass, you know, to the top. And you do realize that things that you've done in the past, you can draw on, you know, on previous learnings. Your gut feeling becomes a lot more fine-tuned or you know, experience-based, not just gut-based.
And like, what's the motivation to get into this adventure again?
For me personally, the motivation was, I like conquering new heights. I like trying to do things better than I did before, even when it's not easy, you know, even if you've done well somewhere. My first startup, Encapsula, was phenomenal. It was a rocket ship. It took off. In hindsight, I look back and I say how easy it was. It was nothing. There was nothing easy about it. Before this current gig, and this is in this current gig as CEO, we're still an early stage startup. So it's not that I'm the founder of the company. But, you know, coming at an early stage, the motivation for me was, again, trying to do better than I'd done before. My wife also told me that she really appreciates the garden being super, super neat and tidy and there being nice cooked food all the time at home. But that it wasn't cutting it for me, and I need to go out and get busy. I also realized that at least, you know, a couple of years ago, when I looked at alternatives of whether I wanted to become an investor or whether I wanted to, you know, I sit on a couple of boards, that it was somewhat frustrating for me, because as an investor or as a board member, there's only a certain amount of control that you have. Like, the only thing a board can really do operationally is fire the CEO and, you know, bringing a new one. And you often want to do things, you've got an opinion on things, you want to try and do them the way you think is right. The only way to do that is being an operator. So being in the business, running the business, not standing, you know, on the sidelines, which is, unfortunately, I mean, I hope I'm not breaking any bad news for anyone that wants to go into, you know, investment. But it's you know, it's very, very different. You've got to realize, I mean, one of my best investors sometimes once said to me, you can't believe how frustrating it is being an investor, seeing the, you know, the companies operate, thinking that you would be able to do better or do things, you know, things differently, and not being able to, because you're, you know, you don't really give directives to CEOs. You want to help them. You want to provide your perspective, but, you know, the CEO has got to take responsibility. The CEO's in the details, with all due respect. You can't be on the sidelines and be, you know, in the details and really understand things. And if you want to be in the details and understand things and be effective in what you're doing or in your impact, you got to be in the you got to be in the field running it yourself.
You're saying like every startup is a different story, which is true. I understand that. But it also sounds like that you're saying sort of like a video game. You're going up a level. Like, you're looking for like the going to the next league. So you're actually challenging yourself more than the, you know, it's not doing the same thing in the same level. You're trying to get better, which is, you know, you're frustrating yourself here.
It's true. When I finish a race, I run, you know, I run kind of long distances. When I finish a race and I break a record, that becomes the next thing you want to break. The challenge is when you're actually in that sport is the older that you get, the harder it gets. So you're kind of literally on a double, you know, it's like walking up an escalator that's going down. Like if you stay static, you're actually, you know, going down. That's why they have age categories for athletes. But Ronan, I think it's do you enjoy, not even do you enjoy the challenge, but do you like to challenge yourself? You know, that's kind of that's probably what, you know, if we were sitting, if I was literally just sitting on a couch right now and we had to kind of dig into the bottom of why we do it, I think a lot of it's, you know, trying to beat your previous record or do something that's different. It's probably the core of why many of us set out to do it.
There's a sentence saying it's either move it or move it, right? So, you know, like if you're not going forward, you're probably going down. But on that sense, but is it a relevant thing? Because it sounds to me like when you said about the investors, so this is something actually I heard from a lot of people. But me, myself, by the way, I agree. I hate being an investor. This is like it's the worst position in the world, in my opinion. It's being an enabler. I'm actually horrible at it, in my opinion. Okay. Like and it's really frustrating. So I know that. But on the other hand, it means that literally we were fighting for relevance. Like, you know what I mean? Like it's to a tribute, right? But it's also a relevant thing, isn't it? Like you just want to think, do you want to be the best at these startups? What do you want to be?
You know, it's kind of how high do you want to create the bar? Or you know.
Fair enough. Agree.
You know, with all due respect, I've never looked at, you know, at Elon Musk and said, hey, I'm going to, you know, do better. And I use him as an example because he's probably one of the top two or three, you know. I like to take on a realistic challenge. Maybe I'm not a big enough of a dreamer, which is, you know, something I'm willing to come to terms with. I'm probably more of a realistic of, you know, can I build a good outcome there? I like to set goals relative to where I am or what I've done in the past and see if I can supersede them. You know, that's kind of, I think the what helps me set the bar.
But you always do end up going to the best. I mean, if we look at the startup that you've sold, that was a very impressive achievement. And then working in Nexar or in Bessemer, those are like Bessemer is one of the top VCs in the world. So you do make sure that you're among the best.
With all due respect to my year that I spent at Bessemer, I wasn't a full-time investor. I was what's known as like an executive in residence. In fact, I was taking a sabbatical, and the one of the really good partners at Bessemer when I was living in Silicon Valley said to me, if you're going to do nothing, come do it here, which was a great experience, you know, being an operator or entrepreneur and then seeing the other side. And you know, since then, I've gotten more privy into, you know, other VCs and how they operate, and what I think Bessemer is one of the best in the way it operates.
What makes them the best?
I didn't say that they are the best. I said that they are one of the best. Mm-hmm. First of all, the quality of people there is phenomenal. I don't want to go into too much detail, but the investment model that they've got there on checks and balances. There's no investment committee per se that has to make a unanimous decision on how they make decisions, on how there is accountability. And on the other hand, there's also shared responsibility. I think that they strike a really good balance on how to, you know, motivate very, very good individuals to be part of a team, but to also try to excel as, you know, as individual investors.
And they also have their track record of success.
Absolutely.
No, sure, but how?
So I only spent a year there, and you should probably, you know, have Amit or Adam, the Israeli partners here, to probably could be a good episode with one of them as well. Just, you know, I think that one of the things that really struck me with Bessemer is when I looked at their numbers, and Bessemer's. One of the older VCs out there, even during really tough times, like, you know, the dot-com bust, the 2008, you know, economic crisis, the fund still did well, which, you know, at least from my perspective, kind of proves that there's a method to the madness. It's not just gut investments. But get one of the Bessemer guys on the show, I think it's or on the I think it could be an interesting topic.
I agree, and I'm wondering, because you said earlier that it doesn't, you know, in this sport it actually gets harder, but it seems sort of counterintuitive to me, because don't you also get wiser and you have your experience, so why is it harder?
Well, I didn't say it gets harder in the startup sport. I meant in my own my own running sport that I do. I do long distances. It gets more difficult to break your records as you grow older.
No, the difficult is getting better. It doesn't mean the business, it's inside the business you want to get better.
It's true. I also think that I think specifically in the cybersecurity space, which is really the space in which I've spent most of my time for the last 20 years, it's gotten more difficult. There are way more companies, it's more competitive, there's more money that's gone into it. There's less white spaces. Same way as real estate now in certain areas has become crazy because there's no more opportunities. The market's, saturated with players. So it's definitely not getting easier from that perspective. I spent a year outside of the space. When I joined Nexar, I realized quickly that there were two things that didn't work for me. I wasn't operating as CEO there, which was turned out to be a challenge personally for myself. And I also felt looked at alternative opportunities that I had playing fields in which I had the ability to execute better. And I felt that it was, there's one thing that I learned, especially when you raise three kids, and I've grown up kids already, Noah and I were discussing it before I got on the show. I think one of the things that I realized that you got to try and foster strengths and not necessarily constantly try and compensate for your weaknesses or if you're not good at math and you're not gifted, trying to force yourself to be really good at math is not going to work. If you're, if you're good at math, then invest heavily there. And I give that because some kids are really, really good at math and some kids are not. And we tend to try and get the kids that are not really good at math to be, to invest a lot of the time. And it's always going to be a challenge for them. And they're not going to be really, really, really successful in it. It's, I think it's finding strengths and finding areas in where they have got the ability to execute well and trying to foster that and have them spend most of their time doing well, getting fulfilled, building self-confidence. Life is more than just, doing honors in maths or in Israel, as we call it, five units of maths.
We're excited to be collaborating with the Israeli website CTech, owned by Kalkalist, Israel's leading business newspaper. CTech is the gateway of the Israeli high tech to the tech world and vice versa. If you're not already a regular reader, we strongly recommend that you check out kalkalistech.com, kalkalistech.com, to stay up to date on all high-impact stories from the Israeli tech scene.
In the journey, do you feel like there's a thing about the difference between journey and destination now in the way you're approaching startups? Like, was more of an exit thing in the beginning and now it's more like also the journey is important to you and how you do things?
The journey is definitely important. I think that the first startup I did, I wasn't that young. I'd had some previous gigs, not as a founder or later on as a CEO, but you kind of don't know what you're getting into. There's the innocent bliss. You really don't know what you're getting into. And some of it, by the way, is really, really good because you sometimes you take on challenges that people that kind of know the facts and know what the odds are say, no way I'm doing this. Okay, this is kind of crazy. The first time was successful. We had a great outcome. We built a really nice company. And one of the things that we tend to forget sometimes are the fact that it wasn't that easy, or putting it lightly, it was damn difficult. And it's like kids when they wake you up at night, you're saying, I'm not having any more kids. And 3 years later, you land up having more kids. We tend to forget some of those things. And, I think doing it now kind of for the third time, the journey is important. I also think, the things that I've learned along the way is surrounding yourself in people that you want to spend the journey with. I think, I'm fortunate enough that as CEO, I almost get to pick people that I can that we can partner with. I mean, obviously, I don't. There's some people I would like to. I would like them to join the journey, and they don't want to join this journey. They've got alternatives, but you're in the seat to define who's going to join the journey, what's the DNA going to look like, what's the you know, you've got the ability to shape some of that. You know, the journey is I think one of the things that I've learned to do, still not well enough, and I'll admit it, is celebrate wins. We tend to focus, I tend to focus very much on this, you know, on the things that we need to constantly improve on. And I look at and I see some of the, you know, all the things that are not working versus the things that are, you know, that are working. And there's a lot that is working. I don't know if it's everyone in my seat that focuses on the, you know, on the, what, constantly optimizing and trying to squeeze, you know, some more out of it. There's definitely celebrating the wins is definitely something that's that I could definitely do better at, and I think that would also help the you know, help the journey.
But I think maybe it also helps you and becomes your drive, because you want to be in control and be able to optimize what isn't working. And the second that you're not there, then you feel this frustration and that you're not in the lead. So in a sense, I think your ability to see what's not working and focus on it in order to improve it is also the enabler for very large growth for you.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. I don't know if it's a personality thing as well. It's kind of constantly looking at what you're missing out on, or how you could do better, or if you got 90, if you could get 92 or 95.
Was it always this way?
It was. I'm very competitive. I played competitive sport when I was a kid. I played tennis. And I, you know, I literally spent 4 or 5 days a week on a tennis court. School was in between tennis. I was never like number one or number two. I was like in the top 12 or 16 for my age group.
Where?
In Israel. Back in the 80s.
With Harel Levy.
Harel Levy is a little younger than I am. Eyal Ron is my age.
Right.
Literally, I think he's a year older than me, or we're the same. It's because we used to play in the same age groups. So I've always been competitive. You know, I've tried to be as good as I can. I appreciate hard work.
Having been a tennis player, the hard work, being an athlete means if you work really hard, you can see the fruits. You know, you working hard, you get better. It's like the ratio, the mathematics of your brain says, if I work very hard on whatever forehand, then at the end of the day, I'll have that forehand. The question is this, though: by playing tennis, so you just said, okay, I'm playing tennis professionally, so I'll just be in cybersecurity. I'm missing something here.
My journey into cybersecurity was total coincidence. You know, I didn't serve in a
intelligence unit. Yeah.
An intelligence unit. I wanted to say in a keyboard unit. I did a very physically intense military service. And in fact, when I, in high school, you know, I studied maths and physics and chemistry, and those were my major in, you know, in high school, but I never saw myself actually leaning towards the, you know, the technology. It didn't grab me enough. And I almost say that my whole career or my whole journey into tech was a fluke. My first job was actually at a paper mill. There's one paper mill in Israel, so you can guess where it is.
A paper what? I'm sorry?
A paper mill.
Mill, okay.
I literally had just gotten out of the military service. A friend of mine from my military service, his dad worked there in the information systems department, was one of the programmers that built their information systems. And they said to me, hey, we're looking for someone to come here at 6 PM and stay here till 8 AM in the morning, because we've just rolled out a new system and the paper mill works 24/7. And if there's any issues with the software, there's 100 different stations throughout the factory that you need to go out to and say, hey, let me help the workers, you know, blue collar workers that are operating this new software. You got to train them. You got to make sure that they're operating this correctly. So be kind of on call support for the night. Now, for me, that was great because 3 months later, I would typically be lying in 0 degrees in the mud in a bush somewhere. So sitting in a heated office on a seat from 6 o'clock in the was upgrade. I was making really, really good money. I was trying to save money for a, you know, post-military vacation or, you know, trip. And I started there. I knew very little about computers. I had a computer when I was like 10 or 11. And as soon as I started playing tennis seriously, I just didn't have time for that. And I didn't do anything with that. And a couple of weeks into my first job there, they said, hey, you know, while you're sitting here during the night and no one's calling you, why don't you start writing documentation for the new system? So I said, sure, you know, I'll start doing that. And then a couple of weeks later, they said, why don't you start doing, you know, QA for the stuff that we build during the day? You come do QA in the night.
Somebody identified potential.
Somebody identified potential. And then towards, you know, like 2 or 3 months in, I said, you know, why don't you teach me to code? Maybe I can actually be good at this thing. And I liked it. And I was planning to go to university. I was planning to study economics and like business. And I said, this computer science thing actually is, or I didn't even know it was called computer science. This whole computer thing was actually something that was pretty interesting. And I signed up and I got accepted to computer science at Tel Aviv University. I studied computer science and economics. That's when the tech boom started, you know, booming here. As a student, you know, second year student, I was now earning way more than I was at the, you know, at the paper mill. I wasn't working at a paper mill. I was working at a startup. I worked my way kind of through my first degree. I worked 50% of the time. I used to go on business trips through my studies. I did like implementations, customer success at a startup. And then when I finished, I moved into a dev role. And then I wrote code for a bunch of years, then moved into management roles, managed a bunch of, you know, development teams. Then at some stage decided that I wanted to move out of the technical side and move more into the business side. And I moved into product management roles. My wife and I at that stage had a young kid. We decided to, you know, let's go experience life elsewhere. And the company I work for relocated us to the US. And 2 years into us being there, I got a phone call. There wasn't even LinkedIn back then. I don't even know how this headhunter found me. He said to me, hey, the company, they're looking for someone to kind of run product management, product marketing for them. I looked online, saw the company, said to him, you know, the company's Israeli. So he said, well, you know, so what? You didn't realize I was Israeli. My name and my accent don't really give that away.
Not really, by the way, but yeah.
I was, I inherited the accent.
But it does not give you away. I would be like, Mark, okay, that accent, it totally gave you away. You're Israeli.
Turned out it was a cybersecurity company called Sayoda. Most people know it as Naftali Bennett's company.
Yep.
And within a couple of months, I joined them. And that was the beginning of my cybersecurity gig. And I think that one of I think it was also a turning point in my career because it was, first of all, I was recruited into, you know, I was at a more influential position at that stage where you get good visibility and you've got a better ability to impact, you know, what's going on. The company wasn't an early stage. It was a founding team. There were probably 50 people in the company. But it was the most pivotal time for the company. It was transitioning, you know, what it was doing into a new field that eventually became the core of why the company was then acquired by RSA. So it was super, super, you know, it was a super intensive year. I literally spent a year there before we got acquired. It was one of my more intensive years, you know, as before a founder or a CEO. The pace in which we moved, it was a phenomenal team. I think it was a really good opportunity to see some really highly motivated individuals that can push really, really, really hard. That's how my cybersecurity career started, essentially 20 years ago. This was 2005.
But then how do you become an entrepreneur yourself? What did you tell yourself?
So first of all, when I saw the guys around me, some of them were founders of the company, you know, I realized that I wasn't any different. You know, and I think that that's a common theme. You kind of find that the reason why a lot of people from certain units in the Israeli military actually go and succeed is not necessarily because they have the technical skills or they've got the background. Obviously that succeeds, but they've got role models that they say, hey, if that guy who I was 10 times better at university, that, you know, or at school, or I used to crush him at tennis or whatever, if they were able to do it, and if you've got a competitive nature, then you say, okay, that's, you know, then I can definitely do it. So, you know, that's part of the mindset. The, you know, starting the entrepreneurial journey was, you know, I don't want to say another, you know, luck or, you know, but we moved back to Israel after 5 years in the U.S. We decided that we want our kids to be Israeli. We relocated with one kid. We moved back with three. And I had the opportunity. I think I bumped into Shlomo Kermer in a cocktail party at RSA, and we started talking. And I had an idea back then, which was kind of some related to some of the stuff that I was doing in RSA. And Shlomo and I started having a couple of meetings. And at one stage, he said to me, "Hey, there's this guy here who's planning on building a startup. Why don't you guys meet? Maybe you guys can team up together." And we met and we teamed up, and that's kind of how we started the journey. You know, a lot of it was, it seemed natural back then.
Like in hindsight, you're sort of telling it like it's very random. Like, I feel that it's something, like, I literally feel, which is amazing because I know how successful you are, like thinking you're explaining it like you're actually a little bit surprised now that you're telling it by linear timelines, then you're surprised how it sort of played out. You know what I mean? Like,
it sounds like I'm surprised because the whole journey wasn't premeditated. Now, I don't think you can premeditate an entire journey because, you know, our life is often a set of opportunities that you need to decide whether you're going to capture them or not, and whether you've got the, you know, whether you're in position to capture them, whether you've got the guts and the drive to try and pursue them. You know, one thing I can tell you, we're at certain decision points. I remember calling up my dad one day. I was in New York, and my dad knows nothing about tech. And I explained the dilemma of leaving the company that I was with, joining Sayota, and kind of, you know, sounded like the right thing to do. And he said to me, you know, just do it. You know, it's don't be scared. By the way, that's a great lesson I try to instill in my kids. Don't not do something because you're scared of doing it. I mean, there's good reasons why you don't do something, but don't let fear itself, you know, hold you back. And I also tell people, and I tell my kids, if you're going to embark on a new journey and you have no butterflies, you have no trepidation whatsoever, you're probably not challenging yourself enough, or you're not stepping out of your comfort zone. You're doing kind of something that you feel comfortable with, which is, it's okay to stay there if you want to, but if you do want to challenge yourself, then, you know, do something that you, you know, that puts you out of that comfort zone.
And then it couldn't have been smooth sailing. Like, I think in a sense you were seizing opportunities and you had the gut to do so, but also you had the drive, I think, maybe because you're competitive, and I think you were able to identify what can take you to the next level. But were there times where you felt like maybe you need to take a safer path?
I don't like the term safer. It's not that I don't like the term. I don't like the safer path. Safer to me sounds like, hey, you don't want to roll the dice enough. You don't want to be, you know, aggressive enough. There's a risk reward equation in everything you do. If you want to, if you want a high reward, you got to take risks, you got to work hard, you got to do things that are unconventional in order to. I mean, there's always luck in what we do, but luck typically has got some type of assistance to it. You know, that's typically what reality shows.
Do you think some people shouldn't be entrepreneurs?
Yes, I don't think that entrepreneurship is for everyone.
Who is it for?
I think it's for people that are willing and able to work hard, who like the fight. And when I say like the fight, it's not, you know, I'm not saying that in a derogative way, but they like to celebrate, you know, the end of a, or the you know, getting to different peaks or getting to different heights.
Although you don't.
I do. I think that I don't celebrate every step. I think that my threshold for celebration is high. what I really meant earlier to say is I think I need to lower my threshold for celebration. You know, some people will say until we IPO, there's no celebration.
That is awful.
I know that. I mean,
is that a way to manage yourself? Like, I find that a lot of entrepreneurs, because like they're, you know, it's sort of like a hero. You sort of have to manage yourself. Okay. So is it like a managing skill that you're like hard on yourself? Meaning, okay, you don't celebrate these KPIs. You can do better than that. You know what I mean? Like maybe like a tennis player, all right? You made a grand slam. So once you don't make the medal, the Olympic medal, like, I don't know, Djokovic in the last tournament, then what are you going to celebrate, another Masters? You know, because you have to manage yourself.
I don't know that you can teach it or that you can control it. I haven't done good enough of a job to kind of get myself to genuinely celebrate wins that I don't believe are really significant accomplishments. I actually hate the whole everybody gets a prize mentality. Let's celebrate for the sake of celebration. And I think I'm too hard. I've got people on my team that I think that balance me out, you know, from that perspective, because I think that it is important. And I think I also need to recognize that while I'm looking at the macro picture and I'm looking at the eventual, you know, outcomes and the really, really, really big achievements, people are working really hard on some of the smaller tactical things that eventually create the, you know, the bigger win. And we have to give them the satisfaction of and recognition for the good stuff that they're doing. I'm constantly learning. That's one of the things that I'm learning as well.
I'm thinking perhaps you're a bit hard on yourself here, because I'm also hearing the father that you are and how you're saying at the end of the day, you're trying to encourage your kids to improve at what they're already good at the baseline. So I think perhaps, and probably as a CEO as well, you are encouraging people, you're stretching people, but encouraging them to grow within that stretch.
That's a good description, Noah. We want people to be successful. We want people to be motivated. We want people to feel recognized for what they're doing. The journey that we're on is also a journey of thousands of little components to it. We do need to make sure that those that are responsible for the smaller parts of the components, you know, are fulfilled and they're happy with what they're doing and they're getting recognized. Even if we've still got a long way to go until I can say, hey, good job. C'est la vie for me.
You know, we're seeing that a lot of the peak performers that we speak with are also athletes. And I think that in many ways, you just have the athlete mindset. And it's just across the board.
The advantages of athletes, by the way, is a few attributes. That's funny because it comes back each time. One is because in a young age, they had to give up socializing to be better at the sports. They understand that, you know, giving, there's a price to pay, okay, to get better. Second, they achieved something by practicing. Usually people don't believe, like if I try really hard, maybe I'm not going to get it anyways. But an athlete, he actually practiced and he saw, you know, the advantages of getting that. They also have, even if you're a single sport, you have a team around you. So you have to trust your team, okay? And the most important thing, in my opinion, is they also know that they have to, there's a tournament, that there are rules in the tournament. You know what I mean? Like there are shortcuts, but there's not, you cannot break the rules. Okay. There's like, you know, there's the rules of this tournament and you have to play by those set of rules. So they have like ethics to the mannerism. And I think when you implement that in a very young age, it has a really big advantage to a mindset of a person that's a leader of the team. And it totally explains, by the way, in your sense, if I have to think of the psychology of it, of course you cannot be the VP and you have to be the CEO as a singles tennis player. Okay. Cause you know, like it would be very unnatural for you, because I think like that's your place. Like you probably led your team together with you. You're great as a tennis player, got great advice, got great coaches, got great mental, whatever, you know how to listen to them and work with them. Okay. But you are the tennis player.
And I also want to add that, and especially in a tennis, I think you also have the ability to imagine a reality and then practice and create the way to it.
I agree. With all due respect to both of you, I think that the most important lesson that you learn, especially in an individual sport,
yeah,
is how to deal with defeat. There's amazing stats, and in fact, Federer is you know, if you listen to some of his inspirational talks. Federer won, if I'm not mistaken, 54% of the points in his career. He lost 46% of his points. After every point, you've got to say, on to the next one. You can't think back. You've got to look forward. You've got to completely put that behind you. You've got to, and you don't win. You most tournaments, you lose. You don't win most your tournaments. There's very, very few players that actually win. When we tend to think about tennis players, or we tend to think about top 10 tennis players, and not even top 10. Most of us think about the top three, okay, that are consistently winning. By the way, they're not winning every Grand Slam every single year. They're looking to break records. You got to, you know, after every loss, which is devastating, because you're trying to break a new record, and it's really, really, really important for you. You got to get up the following morning and say, damn, I'm going to get back onto the tennis court and I'm going to, you know, hit more balls and I'm going to try and improve. Yelden Jerby talks about it a lot as an individual, you know, judo fighter. That's a lot of it is dealing with, you know, with failure, dealing with setbacks, building resilience to you know, trying to funnel that frustration into hard work and trying to find things to do, you know, to do with it. I think that's what, in my opinion, gives me a lot of gives a lot of strength.
How do you do it, cope with defeat? How do you do that? Next point. Because I have to say, as opposed to a lot of other sports, sorry to getting into the tennis geeking out on it, but tennis is very unique in the way the points are gathered, because it's not accumulated. It is actually, the next point is like a new game. So it reminds me about business and startups, because there's a never ending. It's even worse than tennis, because there's no three sets. It's like, so how do you get up from a defeat? What would be your tips?
I don't know if there's, you know, one tip. I try to just keep going and really, you know, try to think positively and what can we do? And I'm not very sentimental, for better or for worse. Meaning I'm okay ditching previous decisions or, you know, things that, or initiatives that are, you know, that are not successful, and saying, okay, let's move on. Let's try something else.
So it's like ego. Is it ego? Is letting go of ego as a practice?
I don't know if it's about ego. It's about, again, trying to look forward. I think that dwelling in what could have been or missed opportunities, you know, no one's found the way to turn time back. Literally, you know, get on to the next point and see what we can do at this, you know, at this point in time. You know, tennis is great because there's no time limitation. You can literally be, you know, one set down, five games down, 40 love down. You can come back. I mean, odds are slim, but you can still come back.
You can always, yeah.
So, you know, there's no, it's not like, you know, a sport that's played on time that you run out of time. I think this conversation has really started to draw a lot of parallels between tennis and...
It's not coincidental, though. I really think that the fact that you're first and foremost an athlete is affecting how you are in business and life.
Could be. There's no control set here. You can't put me in a different environment and say, let's look at life without the tennis.
So so it's really difficult for you to celebrate. So let's think about this. What would be the next thing you would celebrate?
Every deal we do, I try to celebrate.
Try. What will you be really celebrating?
You know, I think a significant milestone for the company is the ultimate, you know, the ultimate celebration. It could be a, you know, significant fundraise. You know, companies have got, you know, milestones. It could be a significant partnership that you know, could potentially unlock a lot of opportunity. IPOs, you sell the company. These are all milestones that are, you know, are monumental for, you know, for the company that I think are definitely worthwhile celebrating. You know, and as I said, I think I as an individual can get a lot better at celebrating.
What would you say your superpower is?
I want to think of resilience as one of them.
Would you say persistence? Maybe.
Yeah, I think that persistence and resilience is
yeah, they're similar.
Is similar.
They're family.
I think that I connect well with people. I think that the people that are around me like being around me. I'll just put it that way. I mean, you asked me about superpowers. It's not the time to be modest.
Correct.
You know, I'm not the smartest kid on the block. I try to learn from patterns. I try to look at things and see, okay, is there a pattern here? Because if there's a pattern here, then I can replicate it. So I do a lot of retrospecting and analysis of things. I like selling. You know, you ask me about what gets me going. I really like getting on a call with a prospect and getting them to buy into my vision. I mean, getting them to buy into my vision is eventually, hopefully, will translate and getting them to buy into the product that we build here as well. But, you know, getting them, you know, excited about what we're doing, getting them to relate to it, getting them to also kind of contribute back and say, hey, why don't you guys consider doing this or that as well? And getting that great, you know, feedback and saying, hey, that's something that we can really use now to take elsewhere and replicate elsewhere. I think that's something that I get a lot of satisfaction from. I mean, if I look at kind of the day to day, let's not go as far as celebrating, but when we talk about the good things that I have, you know, often during my days when I talk to customers and I can get them to, you know, to buy in, that's a lot of satisfaction. Believe it or not, most prospects don't buy in. That's just the numbers game. Those companies that succeed, or those companies that their conversion rates are better than others, but no one has 100% conversion rates, and no one has almost more than 50% conversion rates. So you're literally constantly dealing with failure, with rejection. You've got to learn to internalize it and just, you know, run with it.
And your kryptonite, your weakness?
I actually think I've got a lot, but I can't come up with one that I think is...
that you like the most.
You know, sometimes I think that I'm not outgoing enough. Although I'm definitely not an introvert. Again, I think that not celebrating is a weakness. I mean, one of the things that I've learned to do, and this is kind of an anecdote, is often in this business, you get really close to a pivotal moment. You're at the cusp of doing a really big deal, you know, not even talking about really, you know, bigger outcomes. And there's some people that say, I'm not going to imagine the outcome because I'm scared of the disillusionment of after I've envisioned the outcome and I'm going to get so put down because of the fact that we didn't hit it. I've stopped doing that. Actually, if I'm in a position to believe about something and to see it happen, I actually try to enjoy that sense that it's almost close. Maybe I've gotten to realize that I'm not scared of failing. Meaning, if it doesn't happen, you know, I'm not scared of the fact that it will disillusion myself. My wife often says to me, "Don't celebrate. You're going to get disillusioned. Screw it. I'm going to enjoy the not real euphoria because it hasn't really happened. Because that's sometimes the only thing you've got to enjoy because you're constantly, you know, you're often you really get just one event like that in a journey. Enjoy some of the unreal or the imaginary, you know, success. Screw it.
That's fascinating because you don't really allow yourself to celebrate when it happens, but you allow yourself to sometimes almost celebrate before. And I think it's fascinating because I think you have a very strong inner game. So you understand the power of being able to already feel it, because you know how being able to almost hold it in your hands right now is getting you closer to actually making it happen.
Could be. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, going back to sport, there's a lot of visualization that goes on and you know, kind of, you know, running through points and doing motions and, you know, visualizing it. Maybe I need to go back to play tennis.
That would be a great conclusion.
Mark, thank you for your time and thank you for doing this interview. And we wish you to be able to keep visualizing, but then also to be able to celebrate the small steps along the way of this really remarkable journey.
All right. This was great being on this show. It was almost like sitting on a couch, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah,
and if others are listening to it, come get a free couch session with Noah and Ronen. pretty good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all for today's episode. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to our podcast so you never miss an episode. Also, if you have a moment, we would really appreciate it if you could rate and review our podcast on the platform you're listening to. This will help others find our show. And as always, if you know anyone who you think would enjoy our podcast, please share it with them. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back as usual on the first of the month.
Real life
superpowers.
Up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology.
It's alive.
Real life
superpowers.